Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll meet Utah author Sarai Wilson. Best-selling author Sarai Wilson says she's never jumped out of an airplane, never climbed Mount Everest, is not a former CIA operative. She has, however, been madly passionately in love with her soulmate, is a firm believer in happily ever afters, which is why she writes a romance. She grew up in Southern California, graduated from Brigham Young University with what she calls a semi-useless degree in history. She's the oldest of nine children. She currently lives with the aforementioned soulmate and their children in Utah, along with their cats. The cats do not get along. The children do, sometimes, she says. We'll talk with Sarai Wilson, whose latest book, A Tribute of Fire, gets her into a new genre, romanticism. Talk with her following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to meet Utah author Sarai Wilson. Sarai Wilson is a best-selling author. She says she's never jumped out of an airplane, never climbed Mount Everest. She's not a former CIA operative. She has, however, been madly passionately in love with her soulmate, a firm believer in happily ever afters, which is why she writes romance. She grew up in Southern California, graduated from Brigham Young University with a semi-useless degree in history, she says, and is the oldest of nine children. Currently lives with her aforementioned soulmate and their children in Utah, along with their pets and, of course, the children. Sarai Wilson, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So I want to get into this latest book, A Tribute of Fire. This is a new genre for you, romanticy. So romantic comedy, I guess, is what you've been writing. But I want to get to know you a little bit. So Southern California, grew up there. Were you a reader as a child?
Very much so. We were pretty poor growing up. You know, you can imagine having nine kids, but my parents were avid readers. And my mother used to get those Harlequins by the truckload, that subscription that they had. And so I always had romance novels in the house, and we always had my dad was big into fantasy. So that's kind of what I grew up on. And as I got older, I thought I was very sophisticated for a while and would only read the classics. But then I started missing that romantic element. And I thought, this is what interests me. This is what I enjoy. This is what drives me. And when I started writing, that's what I wanted to write. And that's where I headed, was over in that direction, because I just loved it so much.
When you were in your classics only period, do you remember what you read?
Oh gosh, I was like such a huge fan of Mark Twain. I did a senior thesis on Mark Twain in high school, my AP English class. Loved, who else do I really love? I love Shakespeare. I have his collection downstairs. Jane Austen is one of my favorites, but I still read them, still love them.
I was just thinking the other day, I don't know if an author's had so much influence, greater than Jane Austen. You have, explosion of Regency novels. That comes directly from Jane Austen, I think.
Yeah, it does. And especially, I think, out in this market in Utah, because Regency was such a strict period of manners and rules that you can write these romances with these very strict morality rules in place. That makes it a lot of fun for readers.
So that's a direct correlation, I guess, to Utah. Yeah. By the way, just parenthetically, I noticed you have a little notice on some of your novels, steamier than usual.
Yeah, this
so there's a whole thing. There's categories, right? Clean and sweet, and all of this.
Yeah, and it's very hard to define because there is no standard. So you're pretty much running up against every author and every reader's individual standards, you know, and you can't, people will say, how spicy is this book? That's the term they'll use, spice. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know what your standards are. So it makes it very, very difficult in trying to explain this to other people.
So I guess for you, if people are used to what you've done, then you tell them, well, this is a little steamier than usually
right,
what I do.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Do you think, you know, Mark Twain or those other authors bleed over? I could, you know, this is only one Mark Twain book, right? Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court. You have a time travel book.
I do. Yeah. I mean, I can definitely see where that's one that would blend over. I would say probably if anybody, Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters would have the most influence, because they were writing these romances in a time when it was revolutionary, that people were not supposed to fall in love and get married, that it was very much, contractual and arranged. And that's kind of why today, with like you have these generations coming up, like Gen Alpha and Gen Z, who are, we're going to change the fairy tales. She's going to be on her own in the end, and she doesn't have to fall in love. And I just feel like you don't understand how progressive and revolutionary that was in these time periods to have these women choose to fall in love and be in love and have a partner who loved them. We kind of take it for granted now, but those stories are important because that was not how things used to be. And so, yeah, I think I can see those kind of classical influences, that it is such a big deal, that and getting it to still be a big deal in your writing.
I was reading another interview you gave. You talked about your mother and explaining why she loved escape, right? Romance. Tell me a little bit about that.
When I was 17, I had a sister who was special needs, and she passed away. She had a seizure and hit her neck in a way that stopped the flow of blood to her brain, and she died. And I just remember my mom just watching musicals and reading romances. Like, all she wanted to do was watch movies. And I said, why are you doing this? And she said, because for 2 hours I get to forget. And it stuck with me. And when people ask me why I do this, that's why. And I cannot tell you what it means to me when I get a review. Like, I had one with one of my last rom-coms where she said, I am sitting at my mother's bedside in her hospice, and your book is what's getting me through this. That ability to just kind of ease someone's burdens for a couple of hours. And I think, especially in romance, it's really looked down upon. It's really seen as less than, it's really seen as, light and frivolous. And I think nothing could be further from the truth, because I think the ability to help someone else to make their life a little bit easier for a few hours is remarkable.
So is that why you write in this genre?
It is absolutely why I write. Yeah.
Oh, you mentioned in your bio, a lot of it's tongue in cheek, but you say you believe in happily ever afters.
I do.
That's, I mean, we all want to believe that, right? So this is an opportunity for you and readers to participate in this, even if it's not prevalent in their life.
And I absolutely. And I think, not everything ends well all the time, right? We look at the divorce rate in this country, and we can see that that's just not the case. But what I think it does as well, you'd have to understand that romance novels, that there's been an outcry against them since, like, I would say about the 18th century. Like, I went back and found all these articles from like the 18th and 19th century decrying the effect that romance novels were having on women's brains. And you see it now. It's modern day. Like, it's almost funny. I'm like, you're not saying anything different that hasn't been said for the last 300 years. But the implication being, it gives women unrealistic expectations. I'm like, well, men don't watch John Wick and then go out and get a gun, and start shooting people. We don't ever think that's going to happen, right? Like, we don't say, oh, the negative influence that movie's going to have. But I think with romance, what it does, and this isn't, I don't want to be exclusionary, but primarily romance is written for women by women. And we say, this is what you should be expecting. This is how a man should treat you. This is the kind of relationship you should have. And it teaches women to expect more and to look for someone who's a true partner and who respects you and treats you well. So I do think from that aspect that we should be looking for those happily ever afters. We should be looking for partners that are good partners and have the level of respect that we should be having.
Mostly women, your readers. Do you have men
Yeah,
who read your
I
books?
do. And it's fun. Like, I had a dad I do signing conventions, and that's where like a bunch of authors go and readers come, and everybody gets their books autographed. And I was doing one, and this middle-aged man came over to my table, and he said, I brought my daughter, but I'm not allowed to stand next to her. She's like maybe 16, 17 years old. And I said, well, you're a good dad. He goes, I have to tell you, I like your books. And I just thought it was so funny. But yeah, I got one from a guy, I think he was in his 60s, and he's like, I just love your books. And it was such a cute little like email. Like, I sent it to my editor, and she passed around the publisher, and they were all just tickled because it was just not your typical reader. But yeah, I do. I do get men reading.
Is it a guilty pleasure for them? Is it because society would say, if you're a man, maybe you put a paper cover over this while you're reading it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about Kindles, right? You can just put it on your phone or put it on your tablet, and nobody knows what you're reading. So you don't have to worry so much about that anymore. But I would hope it's not. I think we need to get to a point where we allow people to read and do what they enjoy without the constant judgment and, I'm better than you because I read this or that, or I don't know. I think people should be allowed to enjoy the entertainment they want to enjoy.
So it's a growing industry, exploding, massive amounts of money, extreme popularity. What do you think that says
It
about our current
says
society?
women are hungry for this. And I, from an entertainment standpoint, I do not understand what is wrong with Hollywood. I don't understand why we have 50 Marvel superhero movies, which don't get me wrong, I will go watch them. I enjoy them. But I'm often like, where are the stuff for women? Half your audience is female. And there's nothing that we really want to go and see. It's very few and far between. And I think women, this is one of our few outlets that we actually have these books being written that are what we care about. And I would say with fantasy, my dad's books that when I was growing up reading, by and large, written by men, right? And so what I was seeing is you would have this couple and, he would say, you're hot. And she would say, well, you're hot. And the next page they were in love. And I was like, well, wait, what about all the great stuff that happens in between? And the first time they brush hands accidentally and, make eye contact and the stuff that I think women really enjoy. We watch people fall in love. We love it. I mean, you think about when someone says, I've met this guy, tell us all about him. Tell us about your date. We want to hear it. We really enjoy it. So I can see that missing in a lot of, I think, male dominated art. And so I think women are looking for it and they're hungry for it. And this is probably one of the very few places we can find it right now.
Of course, I guess you have the Hallmark Channel and other,
Yeah.
television, a lot on television, but the movies, you're right, it's all Marvel right now.
Yeah.
I was reading that you're a Star Wars fan.
Oh, such a Star Wars nerd. The stories I could tell you. Yes.
You were saying the one interview asked you your favorite character, Ben Solo, is it?
Oh, yeah,
So
absolutely.
I've lost track of the franchise. I watched the original ones. Tell me about Ben Solo.
So, in the sequels, he is Han Solo and Princess Leia's son. And we don't know who he is until the end of the first movie, but he is Kylo Ren. He's the bad guy. He's wearing a mask like his grandfather, Vader. And it's played by Adam Driver. And he ends up at the end turning back to the light because he falls in love with the female main character, who's Rey, who's played by Daisy Ridley. And he comes back and he helps her against the Emperor, who has somehow come back, which they never explain really. But they defeat him in the end, but then he dies, which I am still mad about. I'm still angry about, still trying to figure out if I can do anything, write a letter to get that changed. But yeah.
When I can't pull this up right now, but you said you're kind of mad at men who run these things,
I am.
messing with these characters. You have a few suggestions for them.
Well, I think about Superman. Does Superman get to be with Lois Lane? Absolutely. Does it make him less of a hero? Nope. Does Batman get to be with his flavor of the week in his movies? Absolutely. And we have the standard where you can be a hero and be strong and still have a love interest, and that's fine. But when it is a female character that is the hero, that is the one, like in the new Star Wars, it's Rey, she's not allowed to have her love interest. He dies. And then she just gets to be strong and on her own, and that's better. And I don't understand why that exists. And I've seen it in multiple franchises where if the female character is the star, the protagonist of the story, her love interest is almost always either taken from her or destroyed in some way. And I hate it. I don't want to watch it. And they're so confused. Like, well, we gave you a lead character that was a woman. Why aren't you happy? I'm like, you didn't give her relationship. The men all get their relationships, but she doesn't. I don't understand. But I think the idea is that to be a girl boss and to be strong and powerful, you don't need a man, which that's fine. But if you've given her one and you take a character like Rey from Star Wars, who wanted a home, who wanted a family, who didn't want to be alone, and that's the entire driving force of that character, and they gave her a literal soulmate and said, the Force created you to be a partnership, a dyad, a soulmate bond group, and then you take him away from her, that's devastating. That is bad writing. So I did not enjoy it.
Do you think this is because the men are driving these projects?
Yes.
There are a few women breaking through, but I guess it's still not as many as we would like.
Yeah, Hollywood is ridiculously high. I've had the chance to speak to several different female producers and directors and some agents and things, and it is predominantly male and driven by male tastes and desires and what they and then what they think women want to see without actually employing them or asking them.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We're meeting Utah author Saraya Wilson today. She's a best-selling author. Her book Royal Date was selected as one of the first winners of Amazon's Kindle Scout program. Her novella Royal Design helped launch Amazon Publishing's Kindle in Motion technology. Other books include Royals of Monterra, The Friend Zone, Roommaid. The new book is in a new genre, romanticy. It's called A Tribute of Fire. When we come back, we'll talk about this following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're getting to know Utah author Saraya Wilson on today's program. Her books include Royal Date, Royal Design, Roommaid, Friend Zone. The latest is called A Tribute of Fire. And just very shortly, we'll begin talking about that one, a new genre for her romanticy. Before we get to that, Saraya Wilson, you have a very compelling story about how you wrote your first book. This is not usual. Tell us this. Or maybe it is more usual than we think. Tell us how you came to write your first book.
My very first book, what ended up happening was, I had always loved reading. But I'm not one of those people who grew up and said, someday I want to be a writer. I don't know. I think when you grow up as poor as I did, that doesn't even seem like a possibility. And we were back before the internet. So, there's no way to like look it up and find out how to do it. So it just was never even a thing. And my oldest son was diagnosed as being autistic. And this was, gosh, 23 years ago. And we were like, what do we do? How do we help him? Different things were recommended, but they recommended a certain kind of treatment that insurance that they wouldn't cover. And it was like $10,000. And for, I was pregnant with our second child. We were young. And it might as well have been 10 million. There was no way. And so we set out to do the best we could, again, pre-internet. So no Kickstarter or, GoFundMe or anything like that. Reached out and some people from church donated items to us. And then we were going to have like a multifamily garage sale. And I put out press releases hoping to get like some coverage and things to this garage sale so that we could make some money for him. And I got some responses and one of the reporters called and asked that they could come to my home. And I said, sure. And when I was thinking about how do I raise this money? What do I do? I was praying, thinking, and the answer was write a book. And I'm like, well, that's stupid. I'm not going to do that. But so this reporter came over and I opened the door and she said, before I come in, I have to ask you a question. And I said, okay. She said, are you a writer? And I said, why would you ask me that? She said, because your press release was so well written, I just assumed that you were a writer. And it was like the heavens parting, lightning bolts, bulb above your head. I'm like, all right, I got it. So that's actually how I very first started writing. And I started out kind of writing for this niche market out here in Utah for Covenant, who sells through Siegel. I did a couple of books for them. And it was not a great experience. And so I knew that I wanted to go nationally. I wanted to be like, with the New York publishers and didn't quite know how to do that. I had two more children. And then this kind of indie revolution came along and people started publishing on their own. And I was very excited about that. And there were these well-known authors at the time who said, well, cream rises to the top. So as long as you've got a good book, you'll sell. So I wrote a book that I think is good, has great reviews, but I was selling about 7 copies a month because it is really hard to get found on Amazon, especially now. I mean, now you're talking about what, 30, 40 million books, like it's hard. And so I thought, okay, this isn't going to work. What do I do next? And I had heard someone who wrote books very quickly and put them up and it worked for her. I thought, I'll try that. So I wrote my book, Royal Date, and I finished it in about a month. And the day I finished, my goal was to be with Amazon. Amazon has their own publishing houses. And I thought, well, who better to be a partner with than Amazon, right? Like who else is going to promote you better than they would? So the day I finished, Amazon announced a program called Kindle Scout. And it was kind of like American Idol, but for books. So you could put up like your cover and then your first chapter and readers could vote. Yeah, I think this is good or no, you should pass on this. And even if you got a lot of votes, it didn't mean anything. Like Amazon could still pass. And it's just hard to explain, but the fact that it was announced on the day I finished this book, I was just like, I'm going to enter that and I'm going to win. I just sort of was like, almost like this knowledge, like this is going to happen. And I did. I was one of the first 10 winners. And the woman who ran the contest contacted me and said, "Why'd you enter?" And I said, "Well, I would really love to be with Montlake, who's their romance house someday." And she goes, "Well, that's great." She goes, and so next thing I know, I'm getting a phone call from a woman who works there. Her name is Anne, who at the time I did not know this, but she is the editorial director of Montlake. And so I thought this was a foot in the door, networking, nice to meet you. And at the end of the phone call, she says, "Well, we're going to offer you a 2-book contract." And she makes fun of me for it to this day. Like 10 years later, she still makes fun of me because I was so in shock because this is not how publishing works at all. So when people ask me, "How did you get published?" I'm like, "I'll tell you my story, but it's not going to be helpful to you like in any way, shape, or form because this just doesn't happen." So yeah, I start off there and I've been with them for almost 10 years now, and they helped me get my agent, and they're the ones who bought the Romantasy as well. So I've been with them for a long time.
It can be kind of a catch-22, can it? Approach a publisher, they want you to have an agent.
Yeah,
But
I mean,
to get an agent, you have to have a published work. It's kind of a
you are
catch-22.
exactly right. And that's the thing, and that's one of the reasons why I started off in this regional market was I thought I can get published here and then I can approach an agent, right? That was the plan because you're right. The agent wants you to already be popular. And that's one of the nice things that indie or self-publishing is doing these days is that you can find success on your own and become very popular and then be approached by publishers and agents. I see it all the time. So.
So your story is pretty unique, but what advice would you give to maybe first of all on the just on the writing side, and then maybe on the business side?
On the writing side, I would say read, and that probably sounds silly, but you'd be surprised how many people want to write books who don't read. And I think you absorb so much from reading just instinctually that you don't even realize about how to structure a story and how to characters' viewpoints. So I think reading a lot, especially in the genre that you want to write in. I think romance, we get a lot of, "Well, I'm just going to write a romance and I'll just rattle it off and then I'll make a ton of money." And that doesn't happen. Readers know when you don't love it and you don't understand the genre conventions. So make sure you're reading and you understand where you want to write. And then I think if you're really serious about being professional, and that's a hard thing. I was in Brendan Sanderson's class at BYU a couple years ago because I wanted to write fantasy. And so I thought, who else better to learn from? And I thought, we're sitting in this class, and I mean, the room was packed. There must have been 80, 100 kids in this room. And he said, "One of you will actually become a professional author." And I thought, and it sounds probably depressing, but he's not wrong. Because people talk about this, they dream about it, but they don't actually do it. So if you want to do it professionally, sit down and do it. And that probably just sounds silly, but sit in your chair and actually write the book and then learn the industry. Authors are probably some of the most giving people on the planet because what we know is no one author can satisfy any reader. So if someone reads my book in 2 days, they still have 363 days for the rest of the year. They want to read other books. So we're very helpful. We want other people to publish because we want to feed readers. So if you really want to learn, Google, how do I get published? There's so much information out there. You can't miss it. And then I would read either join a professional guild, writers guild, so that there's ones geared towards newer writers that will help you and help you learn and help you make contacts. And then read professional books on how to be a writer because there's things you don't realize like until someone like lays it out for you. You're like, "Oh yeah, that's true. I didn't know that." So I would definitely do the work. A lot of people don't want to do the work either. They just want to, they're like, "Can I talk to you about publishing?" And I think there's no way that I'm going to be able to explain everything to you, in an hour or 2 hour conversation. You're much better off learning it on your own than me trying to, reinvent the wheel with you every time. So.
You talked about learning the conventions, whatever genre you're in, learning the conventions. There are conventions you probably have to hit. But on the other hand, you want to be fresh, you want to stand out.
Right.
So how do you balance that?
Well, I think the way that you balance that is your freshness is what you call your voice. That is, I would think if a reader picked up a book, if my name wasn't on it, that they would know that I was the one who had written it because they know me and they know my voice, the way that I tell stories. And you have to have a voice. And the problem with having a voice is something's going to happen to you. People are either going to love it or they're going to hate it. And if you're kind of getting lukewarm responses, that probably means you don't really have a strong enough voice yet. So the freshness comes in the way that you tell stories, and that's going to be refined over time by a lot of practice and writing and putting out more books. But you can't write a murder mystery where someone doesn't get murdered, and the case isn't solved. You can't write a romance where they don't end up together. It's not a romance then. You've written a tragedy or women's fiction or something else. I still have people who say, I'm going to up in the genre and I'm going to up in the conventions. And that's how they think they're going to be fresh. And I know readers are just going to hate you and they're just going to be angry with you and they're going to tear apart your book and tell everybody not to read you. So please don't do that. Understand that, if you're writing a suspense thriller, it has to be exciting and the bad guy needs to be stopped to the end, right? Like that's how these things work. So understand your structure and then you get to play with it however you'd like.
Tell me more about voice. How did you develop your voice? What goes into that?
I think voice is honestly just something that's natural. It's just the way that you tell stories. And I don't know that you can develop it, to be frank. So, I mean, I think maybe it's just time. Stephen King has a book on writing that I would recommend. And he talked about that there's four kinds of authors that he said these have like A, B, C, and D. He goes, A are those exceptional people. This is just an innate gift. They don't have to do anything. They're just these incredible storytellers no matter what they do. He said, Group D is the people who really want to write a book, but they're never, ever, ever going to be good at it. No matter how hard they work, no matter how hard they try, it's never really going to be something that's readable. And then B is pretty good, and C is, yeah, they're good. They can get published. And he said, you can move from like C to B, but that's pretty much the only movement that really exists, that you're kind of going to be one of these four categories. So I think discovering where you're at and then can I improve? He said, very rarely does a B move up to an A, and very rarely does a D move up to a C. Can happen, but he said finding out where you're at and then working to improve and learning all you can and reading and reading and reading, it can change that.
Help you. We'll get into talking about Tribute to Fire, but that's a new genre. But romantic comedy, I guess, is that's how you describe your previous books. Have you've probably seen growth, I imagine, from the first book to the latest books. How do you see that? Is it formation of characters, your voice sharper? What's happened over time as you become a stronger writer?
I think you hopefully become a stronger writer, that it becomes easier, not easier, but you better understand how to convey what you want and that you have a better grasp of character and arcs and things. And one of the questions I often get asked in interviews is, what's something that you know now that you wish you'd known at the beginning? And my answer is always the same. I wish I had known how much harder it gets, that it is the opposite of what I thought was going to happen. Because I thought, well, you start publishing books and you're really good at it, and then it gets easier and easier with each book. That is not the truth. That is not the case. I sit here in front of book 26, doubting myself as much as I did with book one. But what also happens then when you start having this large body of work, especially like in romantic comedy, have I already had this kind of romance? Have I already had characters who had these same issues and obstacles and arc growth? Have I already told this joke? Because I'll tell you, readers will tell you when you make a joke in a book that you made 6 books ago, they will reach out to you and say, you already made that joke. So you become very conscious of this audience who is receiving it and reading it. And people say, oh, it doesn't matter if they read your books, then if you wrote it a long time ago, they won't remember. I'm like, that's true. But then there's readers who reread stuff. And then there's people who find you, and romance readers especially, I will tell you, if they read a book of yours and they love it, they will go and buy what they call your backlist. Every book you've ever written, they will buy and read like in a weekend. So they will know if you're repeating yourself. It's very difficult. And it's something I talk to other authors about all the time. Like, how do you make that part easier? And nobody has an answer for me. But yeah, it's pretty difficult, but I think I have a better sense of what is working and what is not. And so when I get an editor's pushback on something, it makes it easier for me to say, you're right, or no, I don't agree with you, and here's why, that I might not have done at the beginning of my career.
You mentioned a couple of times, and I've read in interviews on the other side. Romance readers tend to consume the book quite quickly. I think you want to get to that happy ending, right? That's maybe part of it. And I understand you write quite quickly.
I do, and it's bad. I would not recommend how I write. It's just the way that my brain works, and it started with that book Royal Date that I wrote in a month. And ever since then, my brain goes, you can write 90,000 words in 30 days. That's not hard. That's 3,000 words a day. That's not difficult. It is difficult. It's terrible. But my husband's always saying, why don't you start earlier? Why do you put all this stress on yourself? I try and nothing happens. And then that 30-day mark hits, and it's like, okay, now we can go. So I do write very, very fast. because I respond to pressures and deadlines. It's one of the reasons why I am traditional instead of being indie, because if I were indie, I don't think I would ever publish again because there wouldn't be anybody making me do it. So deadlines are very helpful, I have found.
But I imagine there is there something gestating, prior to that 30-day start.
Very much
I mean,
so, yeah.
it would have to be, right? You can't come up with everything in just 30 days.
Yeah. And I have friends who outline and I've seen what they do and it makes me want to punch somebody. You know, they're like, we have this board and I put up all these post-it notes. And I mean, if that's what works for you, fantastic. I cannot do it. Mine is just more, I think about things and maybe if like a line of dialogue or a scene pops in my head, I write it down. And I have this document that's just jotted ideas for the book, which is terrible too. Maybe if I outlined it, it would be easier. I don't know. But I'm what they call a pantser, and that's someone who's kind of making it up as they go. So I don't outline and I don't do multiple drafts. You know, I had sitting in a class and someone said, you don't even find the story until the fourth draft. I'm like, I would never in a million years do this. This is terrible. And that's the thing about writing too, is writing is so individual for each writer. And we teach these classes to each other and we're like, you know, my way is the only way. And if an author ever says that to you, run the other direction because that's not true. So you have to find what works for you. And what works for me is writing it quickly, making it up as I go. And I would say the thing that I turn in, my first draft, is pretty much what gets published with very few changes. So that's not typical for other authors either, but that's how I like to do it.
So how do characters, obviously you're creating a character, right? But I've heard other authors say that, the character at a certain point takes on a life of their own and
Very much
kind of
so.
leads out. Does that happen to you?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I hear them talking in my head. I hear conversations and it's like, oh, that's really funny. I need to write that down. I hear their banter, I hear their arguments. I think that's one of the things that works well about my method is that with me writing like in a month, I essentially go into a cave. I am submerging myself in this story. It's pretty much all I'm thinking about for that entire month. So as I'm falling asleep, as I'm waking up, it's always in my head. And so I think it makes it easier for me to write because real life stuff is not getting in as much. So yeah, the characters absolutely have voices of their own. And I would say that once I kind of figure out what the story is, like maybe what the conflicts and the arcs are going to be, what kind of character do I need for the story? And then they start to appear and what traits do they need to have? And what do they, you know, what kind of person are they in response to what I've decided I want the story to be about?
Well, let's do, before we go to a break, I want to talk about, I've been promising this, attributive fire. This is a new genre for you, right? You've been in romance,
Yes.
romantic comedy. This is romanticy, which I suppose is romance and fantasy,
Yes.
which I guess is joining your parents' two interests.
Right? That's why it's so exciting to me. I'm like, I've always wanted to write both, and now I get to write them together. It's awesome.
So attributive fire, tell us a little bit about this, the just plot in brief and how you came about this.
Tribute of Fire is about a princess from a dying nation who's been the nation's been cursed by a goddess, and there is a relic that she can use to restore her lands, but it is in enemy territory. And the only way to get over there is to enter a death race that no maiden in 1,000 years has ever survived. And things are seem to be going her way, and she's planning and preparing until her sister gets chosen for the race as well. So that's the premise of it. And there's a mysterious sailor that she meets, and he's an enemy, and she has a connection with that is kind of throwing a wrench into the works. But the way that the story came about was I was writing a rom-com called The Seat Filler, and I wanted to write a line about Cassandra from Greek mythology. And I wasn't sure I was using the reference correctly. I mean, I'm a huge Greek mythology fan, love it. And I looked it up on Wikipedia. And because I can't just read one thing, I had to read the whole entry. Because, like I said, history major, have to know the whole story. There was a part about what happened to her after the Trojan War. So she was the prophetess, the priestess who Apollo cursed to always see the future, but to never be believed. And so, like, when the Greeks brought in that wooden horse to Troy, she said, there's Greeks in there. Everybody said, you're lying. That's not happening. So she knew the city was going to fall, and she went to the Temple of Athena to get sanctuary and to be kept safe. And there was a man named Ajax the Lesser from Locris who followed her in and assaulted her violently in the temple. Because at this point in history, women were the spoils of war, right? She was meant to be a prize. And Athena was so mad, she demanded the Greeks do something to him. And, you know, the Greeks were like, well, you know, men are going to men. What do you want us to do? And so she was so furious, she blew the entire Greek fleet off course, killed most of them. And that's where the Odyssey comes from. That's why Odysseus took so long to get home. So Ajax got in his boat, borrows a lightning bolt from her dad and blows up his ship, and he somehow Ajax survives, and he's boasting that not even the gods can kill him. And Poseidon took personal offense to that. He opened a rock, sucked him down to the bottom of the ocean, and he died. But to make up for what he had done, Athena demanded that his nation, Locris, send two maidens every year to serve in her temple to replace the one that Ajax had taken from her. And then there was a line that set the whole thing in motion, and it said, "But only if they made it there alive." And I said, "What does that mean?" So I started researching it, and there's the Locrian maidens were real. It happened for 1,000 years. They sent maidens over to Troy for 1,000 years. We have it in Greek histories. It's written in stone. It was a real event. So scholars argue, were they scapegoats? Was it like ritual or ceremonial? I agree with the scholars who think these women were actually killed, because why'd they have to send two every year? If they were just, it just, they never came back home. But they were hunted in the streets. Athena gave the Trojan men permission to hunt these girls in the streets before they reached the temple, and they would be absolved of murder. But I also think they were killed because the Locrians tried for a long time to figure out how to circumvent this rule. They sent infants, thinking they wouldn't kill babies. They killed the babies. They sent pregnant women. The pregnant women got killed. So, they stopped sending maidens altogether, and a terrible plague was visited on them, and they had to visit the Oracle in Delphi to ask what to do. And they said, "Send the maidens again." So it's just not something that's very well researched. I've spoken to several professors of classical antiquity, like over at BYU, and one of them said to me, "You know more about this event than I do," because I went and checked out all these books and read all these articles, because I went to history major. I have to know all the details. So I started thinking, what do these girls feel? What were they going through? What happened? What would you do if you knew this was coming? And they're drawn as tributes in a lottery. And so that's where that story started to form in my head. And like I said, who do I have doing this? And I have someone who wants to stop it. The girl that ended the 1,000 years. And so she'd have to be a princess, because she'd have to have access to resources to be able to train, to prepare herself to fight against these men who are hunting her. So but that's where it came from.
So by the way, you kind of tongue in cheek in your bio, you call your history degree semi-useless. We can understand that in a way. I guess it's come in useful here.
It very much has. And the fun thing about fantasy is that, because I'm not writing a historical, I'm not trying to be accurate and correct. I mean, I want to be, because I majored in history, but I can make up stuff. It's fantasy. There's magic. I can kind of do what I want. And that's very freeing as well.
Now, this novel is not historical fiction per se, right? But he's based on a historical, truth.
No, not at all. Yeah.
You can feel free to just go, flights of fancy here.
Yeah. Like I said, what made it really, really fun. Like, I was worried about what they would wear, and spent a lot of time looking up what they would wear. And I'm like, I can make them wear whatever I want, because that's pretend. So that's what I did.
But it's fascinating that's based on this historical event.
Yeah.
So this will be the first in a trilogy, will it, or first in a series?
Yes. In a trilogy, yes.
Yeah, so Tribute of Fire is the first one here, and the first in, so are you going to be writing more romanticy?
If they'll let me.
Yeah.
So far, I mean, this is, I've been telling people, my romantic comedies very much feel like work. Like, there's a structure there, and I have to make sure, have I told enough jokes? Has this been romantic enough? And am I hitting, these things that have to be hit at certain points? This one, it was 156,000 words, which is about 520 pages, and I wrote it in 39 days. Like, it just wasn't even, it just load out. And book two, which is already written, same kind of thing. It was 175,000 words, 31 days, even less days. So yeah, it was very much just so easy and effortless. So yeah, I would really like to keep doing this. This is
Yeah,
fun.
it depends on sales, I guess, right? This is a
Yeah, depends
business,
on
so
sales. So
yeah,
yeah.
so go out and get the book so Soraya Wilson can continue in the romanticy field. We'll have more with Soraya Wilson following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're meeting Utah author Soraya Wilson today. You can find her at sorayawilson.com. And the latest book is in a new genre, romanticy. It's called A Tribute of Fire. Earlier books include A Royal Date, Friend Zone, Roommaid, and others. She's a best-selling author and based in Utah. Soraya Wilson, I want to talk a little bit about some of your characters? Do your characters just come to you, or do you think about, I guess, certain plot lines? For example, one of your heroines was an aspiring film score composer, party planner. One is this is the seat filler. So the dog groomer who becomes a seat filler and then meets a famous person. I want to start there, but I didn't know there were seat fillers. What is that?
That's a funny story. That happened because I met Adam Driver because of Star Wars.
Ah.
So after the last movie, you know, when Ben Solo dies, I'm like, I'm going to ask Adam Driver if there's a cut of the movie where he lives. I don't know why I said it, but the next day there was this charity auction to meet him at the SAG Awards back in 2020. And I'm like, gonna win that. And I did. And I took my daughter, who was 12 at the time, with me. And we were on the red carpet and meeting these really famous people. You know, Henry Winkler came over and told my daughter she was beautiful. Helena Bonham Carter asked how to spell my name. Carrie Elwes, you know, Christian Bale. And I was fine the whole night. You look beautiful. Good luck tonight. I was doing great. And then Adam Driver walks in. He was a head taller than everybody else. And he starts walking towards us, and my brain turned off. And I don't know if it was like Star Wars or like just because he's a very charismatic person. And I didn't know this at the time, but he hates red carpets and he hates small talk, very much an introvert. So he walks over and he shakes our hands and thanks us for coming, thanks us for participating in the auction. And he said, where are you from? And I stood there and I thought, why does Adam Driver care where I'm from? And he goes, where are you from? I'm like, Utah. You know, it was very embarrassing. So we had this conversation that he pretty much had to lead, and he signed things for us and took photos with us, and very, very nice. Shook our hands again, and he walked away. And like the whole time I'm not thinking. And as he's walking away, I'm like, oh, this is a book, right? Like I went home and called my agent, even though it was like a 3-hour time difference. I'm like, I got an idea for a book. And so she's like, yeah, definitely we're going to write this. And that's the seat filler. And so same kind of premise where a girl meets someone she's a fan of and can't talk. And then I had known about seat fillers where at these award shows, they don't want the audience to ever look empty. So if a celebrity's gotten up to go get a drink or go to the bathroom, or they've left for the night because maybe their category's over and they don't want to stick around anymore, they have people who are seat fillers, and you stand around in formal gowns and they tell you where to go. And so I started looking up seat filler stories, and they're hilarious. And I included one of them. One of the girls was saying you either have to be backstage or in a chair when this light goes on. And so she was in a seat, and then a woman returned and said, get out of my chair. And so she stood up and the light went on, and she didn't know what to do because she wasn't out of the aisle yet. So she said she dropped to her feet, and she was at the feet of Robin Williams. And Robin Williams apparently thought this was hilarious. So he started kicking her with a totally straight face to camera. He's kicking this poor seat filler, like teasing her, you know. I'm like, that's so awesome. So I have a friend who actually does it in her spare time because she enjoys it so much. And she said John Hamm from Mad Men invited her to a party later, you know, afterwards. So it can be a really fun thing. But I am drawn in my rom-coms, especially to people with unusual jobs. And so like I had a cosmetic chemist, and like I said, a party planner. And I actually sit down and talk to people in those professions, in those fields, and get their stories and find out things. And it really helps inform the book and helps inform the characters as well. So I'm a big advocate of research because you never know how it's going to change a story. But yeah, I think picking those characters, it's kind of what's the story going to be first? What's the premise? What's the setup? What's the issue I'm going to have? And then what character and what kind of job would work well with that?
One of your big sellers was called Roommaid. Interesting character here. But you ran into a little bit of a problem. So first of all, maybe just briefly set up, what is the basic plot of Roommaid?
Roommaid was based on an old Time magazine article. There was a period of time where people were like, you can come live in my apartment. I have a 2-bedroom apartment, and you can stay in the extra room as long as you'll clean the house and cook meals for me. And so they called him, the article title was Roommaid. And one of those things I kind of file away. I'm like, well, that's very cute and interesting. I think came out like 15, 20 years ago. But they were like, do you have any ideas? I came across that one that I'd written down. And I thought, so what's the issue then, right? I thought, well, what if I have this character who, she grew up very wealthy. So she doesn't know how to load a dishwasher, and she doesn't know how to do laundry because someone's always done that for her. But she really wants to live someplace nice because she's accustomed to a nicer lifestyle, but she's a teacher, so she doesn't make very much. So that's the premise of that book. And that's kind of where the characters came from for that one.
So I was reading an interview. You ran into a little problem that her love interest, which of course is the guy who employs her, in order for her to make sense for her to be this roommate, he has to be off screen for a period of the novel. And so you had to work with that.
Yeah, because part of what he's looking for this for is he is a dog and he travels frequently for work and he doesn't want his dog to be alone. So this is appealing to him to have somebody who will take care of the apartment and take care of his dog. And then, and like you said, I wrote that, and then while I'm writing the book, I'm like, this is really bad. He needs to be on the page. What am I doing? So I had to go back. We had to do edits, and I had to find ways to kind of insert him back into the story without him physically being there. So whether he's texting or emailing, or whether he's left cute little notes for her, or she's, not supposed to, but she's going through his closet and realizes he's a secret slob. That there's these little touches where you can bring him back into the story. But I have never done that since, and I will never do it again. I do not. You cannot write a romance where half the character's gone for, a large portion of the book. It's bad. So don't do that.
It did well though, that book.
It did, yeah.
We reached the end of our time. So A Tribute of Fire is out. You've already written the second of the trilogy, I guess working on the third one.
Working on the third one, and it's out November 1st, the first book. And in October, Amazon has a program called First Reads, where if you're a Prime member, you can read it for free before it officially debuts. If you're not in Prime, you can pay $1.99. It's Amazon.com/FirstReads. So they do this every month, but A Tribute of Fire is in there this month. So if you want to read it, you can.
All right, go to Amazon Prime First Reads. And if you more information at SarayWilson.com. Sarai Wilson, Utah-based author, Romantic Comedies and Now Romantasy, bestseller. And it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And we'll go out as we do on Thursdays with Leo T. and Skywatcher. Thanks, everybody.
Skywatcher Leo T here. It's one sky, many cultures. Venus gleams low in the west southwest as the evening twilight fades. It sets around twilight's end, looks like a jet coming in. Mars and Jupiter rise late in the evening and show best in the early morning sky. Watch for Jupiter to rise in the east, northeast about 10 p.m. and check out the length of the moons, the Galilean moons. They kind of run right to left in a 45 degree angle in your little telescope or your nice binoculars. The orangey point about a fist at arm's length to Jupiter's right or upper right is Aldebaran. And look straight up and you can see Cygnus the Swan. It appears to be diving straight down along the Milky Way. That's right in the top of the Milky Way. As I write this on Wednesday, October 2nd, looking into the bright blue sky on the edge of Casper Mountain in Wyoming with his new Hydrogen Alpha telescope is Dan Cooper. Reports this as I write on Wednesday.
Well, yesterday I put my Hydrogen Alpha telescope out on the patio, as I usually do, and was looking at the sun from time to time. And in the afternoon, I saw a monster flare, the biggest I've ever seen. And it was pretty exciting. It lasted, a half hour later, it wasn't as big, but it looked kind of like a bright chasm. It was right next to a big sunspot. And so I was watching the news to find out about it. It was the second largest sun solar flare of this solar cycle, the 11-year cycle. And the largest was in May 2024 when we had a lot of auroras. And this one was almost as large. So it has sent a coronal mass ejection directly towards Earth, and we should be watching for auroras Saturday.
Well, thank you so much, Dan, our Sky Watcher up in Casper, Wyoming. It's an honor to know you, and thanks for reporting in for us all on Sky Watcher Leo T.
Also, the comet A3 has made a nice appearance in the evening skies very recently, at least from outer space above Earth. NASA astronaut Matthew Dominic recorded a video of the comet. Shukachan Atlas just above the horizon as the northern lights danced above the Earth. Beautiful video was taken about 200 miles above the Earth from the International Space Station. Check out a link at the Skywatcher site. Comet rises above the horizon just before orbital sunrise amongst aurora and swirling satellites, Dominic wrote. If the comet survives its closest encounter with the sun, it will swing back when the Earth makes its closest approach around October 12th. The amount of gas and dust the comet will give off will determine how bright it will appear in the sky. NASA said the best time to look in the evening or before October 12th as the comet will be above the western horizon after sunset. And surprise, it showed up over the San Francisco Bay Bridge just in the west over the weekend. Video capture shows the comet zooming over the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, California at sunrise. So stay tuned for a report on globular clusters. Globular clusters are still available for deep space observing from our home planet. Now in this first week of October, with the night sky still moonless, set up your telescope or grab binoculars and go to Fish Lake or Iceland. Look up for four remaining ones that Josh Urban calls the last wildflowers. Globular clusters greet autumn. There's Sagittifolia, the arrowhead flower. That is next to Sagitta, the little arrow. It's up there by Delphinus, the dolphin. Queen's Anne lace sneezed from the nose of Pegasus. And watercress by the stream in Aquarius, a little farther south. That's where Saturn resides. So keep looking around. Look up. Get lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.